Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to another episode of Endurance Chat. I'm Floodman11, and today, with the Le Mans test day right around the corner, we decided it would be a great idea to do a sort of 24 hours of Le Mans for newcomers. Everything you would need to know to understand the 24 hours of Le Mans and the classes, the track, why it's relevant, all that sort of stuff, to get you up to speed so that way you can enjoy the 24 hours of Le Mans as much as everyone else in this community. And joining me on this adventure today, we have Cookie Monster FL and Kiwi Chris 1709. What's up, guys?
Howdy, Floodman. I'm excited. I don't know about you guys.
Just this time of year is the best time of year.
Oh, yeah.
Cookie?
I'm doing well. How are you, Flood?
It's a very cold, brisk morning in Australia, but it doesn't matter because we're talking about Le Mans, my favorite time of the year.
It's like Christmas.
It's Christmas in June.
June.
that's how that works, right? Isn't it?
Sports car Christmas.
That's the best way to put it. So, what is Le Mans and why do we care, right?
Le Mans is a race.
But I mean, it's actually a
town. Big race. Oh, yes. It's one of the biggest and best, most historic, most prestigious, most exciting races of the year, if not the most important for us.
Definitely for us. It is part of the Motorsport Triple Crown, of course, which also encompasses the Indy 500 and the Monaco Grand Prix. And it's the longest running sports car endurance race, going all the way back to 1923. So it's bringing up its 86th year this year. The maths doesn't quite work out, but they missed a few years because of the war, of course. But there's a saying about this track and about this race, and that's it all comes back to Le Mans. So, Cookie, why does it all come back to Le Mans?
Well, it's where everybody wants to win. So, every year, regardless of where you end up or where you go, even with Target Florio, everything just ended up coming back to whether or not you won Le Mans. Or maybe not necessarily that, or maybe it was even, yeah, whether or not you won Le Mans that year. So, to me, that's kind of how I always interpreted that quote. And I don't think it's changed very much through the years. I think the level of or the amount of people or the how open it is to potentially win there is a lot more inclusive now, and there's a lot less people that I think generally wake up on January 1st thinking this year we have a shot at winning Le Mans. But I still feel like that passion that is there and the weight and the value of this race is still just as highly sought after as it was even in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, it is the biggest, most prestigious race in the world. And if you don't win at Le Mans, it doesn't matter how fantastic you are as a sports car driver. It's always a missing piece.
It's that usual thing, isn't it? What would you rather, a World Endurance Championship victory or a Le Mans victory?
I'd take a Le Mans victory.
And most drivers would. There's a reason Le Mans is going to be the end of the season from now on.
And yeah, it's a big curtain call on what's going to be the WEC Super Season. But first, before that, we're going to get through this year. There's also another interpretation of that quote, it all comes back to Le Mans, and that is to say that all of the history of sports cars and all of the starting of Grand Prix and developments of car technology and for both race cars and for road cars, safety developments, innovations like disc brakes and air brakes and seat belts and different engine configurations, all of that has its roots in this 13.6 kilometer journey through the Lasarth forest. And that's easier to see if you look at just some of the stories and some of the ideas that have come from trying to win this race. And that's what it is. As Cookie said, trying to win this race brings these sort of developments in and has made racing into what it is today, the absolute powerhouse sport that it is today. We should give a bit of a preview of what this task is. So we've said it already a bunch of times. It's 24 hours of Le Mans. It's 24 hours around the Circuit de la Sarthe, a 13.6 kilometer journey through the French countryside. But one of the unique things about this compared to, say, other 24-hour races like at Daytona or at Nürburgring is that it's on half the track is a public road. And you've got not only that, but because of this, you have no street lights or floodlights when you're driving through the night. You got these massive long straights that go on for kilometers and kilometers. You crest over 300 kilometers per hour 5 times on this lap. Even if you're in a GT car nowadays, which is just ridiculous. There's inclement weather, even though it's the middle of the French summer. There's 4 classes on track, which doesn't sound like, you know, crazy amounts when compared to, say, the Nürburgring, but it just the weight of this event makes every little mistake so much more severe.
And there's a track unlike any other as well. Okay, yes, you've got, you know, Nürburgring, which is 25Ks of terror, and this is 13Ks of terror, but the fact you're flat out for 85% of the lap here, you just don't get that anywhere else.
Not even at Daytona.
And it puts so much strain on your car, your engine, your driver, your tyres, everything.
And yeah, especially the drivetrain as well. And we've seen cars that are normally bulletproof get to the end of the race and fall to pieces. I think everyone here doesn't need to be reminded about the 2016 event, do we, Cookie?
No, we don't.
Let's not have the Cookie meltdown.
Not yet. let's save that for June 17.
That'll happen.
I think my favorite fact about this course as well, though, is okay, it's 38 turns now. It used to be, what, 15, 16 turns?
12. It used to be 12. They used to drive straight from the start line into the heart of Le Mans, do a switchback in the middle of the town, and then just drive all the way down to Mulsanne.
The cars are faster now with twice as many turns as they were back in the 80s.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Even without the chicanes, which was a big deal just because of how slow you have to go. And I think even that aspect of the track kind of highlights how unique it is in terms that you have sections of the track that are almost and essentially just owned by the ACO on a private land that you really can't use or go on. I would assume the chicanes you're really not using when it's not, you know, Le Mans. Then you have other sections of the track, which is basically just purpose-built racetrack, and that you really, it just gets shut down. There's a gate run over it, and you just wait for another 11 months till you can reopen it again. So it's that aspect of almost kind of going from like circuit built racetrack kind of asphalt or tarmac to just kind of a public roads tarmac, then transition back to kind of almost a racetrack just to, you know, for the tight technical bits. I think that's really fascinating, and that it still kind of uses, not necessarily where it's like Albert Park, where it's basically to park, but then you put in really a lot of this fencing. I would really still consider a lot of the track is to be just a typical French road. And that's been the really, I think that's what has kept a lot of people in the mystique about the track, and what has kept people there is just kind of the layout of it and how it hasn't really changed over the years. When you've seen a lot of the tracks lose their, you know, might and power, especially on the calendar season, and to see them fall away and Le Mans kind of just keep its own, you know, course, if not grow. I think that has been really stark in contrast.
And it's something super special because it's not a track that you can go and test at freely or just hot lap at, like, say, Spa-Francorchamps or Dubai or something like that. It's, yeah, as you said, shut off for 11 months of the year, and then you get 10 hours worth of testing before you're racing for twice that length and then some. So it does just hold a little bit of exclusivity because of that, which I think is really, really important.
Technically wise as well. I mean, like, there's stuff that's done at this track that isn't done anywhere else with the triple safety cars. A lot of the pit procedures, that kind of stuff as well. Even to how the finishing classifications are and the modifications that were made to that, you know, following 2016. So yeah, there's a lot of different, just even little aspects to the track, which are just a lot, just even much more different than any other 24-hour race, nevertheless, any other endurance. I love it. And that's not counting the standing starts and the Le Mans starts. So we could even talk about how that was a thing.
And those sort of things, just quickly on things like the Le Mans start, have sort of just shown how far that things like safety and, driver and spectator safety have come along from the days of the 50s and 60s, where it was kind of like we'll care about safety probably sometime, maybe, perhaps a little bit.
Well, 55 really changed that mindset, didn't it? Really?
Yeah, definitely. So for those who aren't aware, and I'm sure there might be a few of you, another part of the It All Comes Back to Le Mans is car safety and spectator safety. And because of the reason for that was that in the 24 Hours of Le Mans in 1955, there was a horrifying accident which has been called now like the deadliest crash. It was the single motorsport incident that claimed the life of over 80 spectators, with some estimates even pushing it towards 110, where a Mercedes SLR launched off of the back of an Austin Healey and found its way into the crowd on the front straight, and just basically bits of the car just tore through people, and it's terrifying. And if you want more information on it, because it's fantastic, you should look through Cookie Monster's post history and find the thread he made about it about, what, 3 years ago, 4 years ago?
Yeah, I think that was for 2015, I think.
Yeah, because it was like 60 years.
A bit, yeah.
I still go back and read that like every year. It's one of the best posts we've ever had, the subreddit.
It was an interesting accident. Obviously, it was a tragedy, and I think that's what brought a lot of attention, international attention, for better or for worse, to, I mean, sports car racing and motorsports. I mean, it was definitely something where you were now very, very aware of the potential calamities that could occur at a racetrack. And so I don't think anybody, you know, had a death wish to then go to a racetrack, but I definitely feel like there was now a newfound appreciation for people who had no idea, you know, what was out there, that, hey, look, there's people and guys that are doing some pretty like dangerous things while, you know, entertaining the absolute crap out of you for a weekend. So I think that, you know, even though it sheds blood, I think it absolutely helped the sport. I mean, put itself even more on the map, especially post-World War II.
And, you know, made things a lot safer for a lot more people afterwards, because, you know, things, the part of the reason that crash happened was because the track was separated from the crowd by like a string of hay bales with cars coming at you at like 300 kilometers per hour.
Absolutely. Sure. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff. We could debate on what is the most safety conscious year. I would say 1969 would absolutely be the most safety, in terms of safety, the lack of safety. It was very stark in 1969 versus, I think, in 1955, it was more just a very brutal wake-up call.
Yeah.
You know, where I think people didn't imagine that something like that would happen, where in 1969 it was almost like, oh, well, we're not doing enough, and, you know, it's being highlighted on the track and by drivers. So that's another good year.
Was it the year Jackie X walked from the Le Mans start and still won the race?
Yes.
The Le Mans start was where they had the cars parked up against the pit wall, and the drivers would run across the track, get in the car and start the car and race off. Now, what happened a few times was that drivers wouldn't put on their seatbelts, and so in protest, yeah, Jackie X walked across the track from pole position and almost got hit by a driver who hadn't put his seatbelt on, and later crashed on that very same lap and passed away from his injuries. So, those sort of things, while important for the tradition of the sport, of course, had to just sort of take a step back because of safety. But now we do a sort of homage to the Le Mans start, where we have each of the cars pull off from that diagonal parked up against the pit wall configuration to start the warm-up lap under the safety car. But now I feel like we should talk about this track itself and about just some of the history that has gone on around this 13.6-kilometer circuit. So Kiwi and I have prepared a little something for you guys to listen to, and I hope you enjoy it. Here's where it all begins, 13.6 kilometers around the Circuit de la Salle. Tricolor waves, and away you fly. First part of the track has this sweeping right-hander as you brake into the Dunlop S's. You gotta make sure the car here is very stable before braking, because even the slightest little bit of oversteer could send you right into the barriers. Prototype drivers will hit this corner at about 260 kilometers per hour, while the GTs are gonna be much slower through this sweeping right-hand bend. Managing traffic here is gonna be imperative to set you up for the rest of the lap. The exit here is slightly off camber as the track runs over this hill. You enter what is one of the most iconic images of Le Mans, the Dunlop Bridge, the longest standing Dunlop Bridge anywhere in the world. Plunge over the top of the hill, quick slip to the left, then another to the right, and then you're into the Forest S's, a beautiful left-right chicane with open-ended camber that swaps halfway through the corner. This is a fantastic spot to take some long exposure photography at night. The large speed discrepancy between the prototypes and the GT cars through this section means that if you're in a prototype, you definitely don't want to be caught behind a GT car. But this is a 24-hour event, and sometimes you have to take that hit to your lap time. If you don't, and you try and push the issue, well...
Oh, that's McNish! That's Alan McNish!
Traffic. Oh, boy, that was...
Oh,
that,
no!
He went for a hole there, boys, that was not there. Oh. Look at the spectators.
Boy, the camera guys. Look.
God, look at that wheel flying. That is a scary...
Run the curb on the exit of the Forest S's and get ready to settle the car for Terre Rouge, one of the most important corners of the track. This corner takes you from the permanent racetrack and onto the public road. Slight dab of the brake, whip it to the right and floor it on the exit as the corner opens up over the bumps. And all of a sudden, you're on the highway to Mulsanne.
The Mulsanne Straight, where you leave the permanent racetrack and go out to the French countryside. Normally, the D338 connecting towns of Limay and Ligny. During this race, it's the entrance way to insanity. This piece of road here is the real magic of Le Mans. It's narrow, fast, and downright terrifying in traffic. At night, the only illumination is from the headlights of you and your competitors. It's very easy to get it wrong on this section of the track, and if you do, and you don't tear your car asunder in the process, it's a long way back to the pit lane.
One of the Ferraris! That's Anthony Davidson!
There's two chicanes. They're meant to be identical. Drivers will always tell you otherwise. Brake too late, you're in the tyres. Race done. Spin out, you're in the gravel. Race stuffed.
Now there's a big spin, there's a big accident coming down towards the chicane. One of the toys, I think it's the number one car.
And if you don't get lost in the headlights, don't get lost in the serenity of the forest, you keep clear of the pandemonium of the traffic, negotiate through the chicanes, show patience and cunning, and keep your wits for 6 kilometres. You face your biggest challenge at the end, Mulsanne Corner. It's a great chance to get by your opponents in traffic. But beware. It's very bumpy. The road crowns. It's easy to lock up here and fire past the corner into waiting gravel or into another car. Many a race has come undone here.
At Mulsanne Corner, Dortch in the Peugeot leads, but he's going left and he's hit the barrier!
After a portion of track like this, most drivers believe a sigh of relief. Not at Le Mans, because the worst is yet to come.
In this last minute, you've gone from 100 kilometres per hour to over 300 kilometers per hour three times. The gearbox is shaky, the engine is screaming for relief, but only now do you come to the fastest part of the track. Try and control the wheel spin as you mount the curb on the exit of Mulsanne Corner, and it's time to fly down the hill. As you shoot through this narrow corridor between the trees, the sunset will be right in your eyes, making it hard to see where the track ends and the grass begins. There's two kinks to the right down this straight, both of them entirely flat out. And if you're following a slower car up ahead, you better hope they see you before you're up alongside them.
I flashed a few times the headlights. I thought, okay, he saw me.
Rocky, do you copy me?
Our stomachs are literally in our mouths. There are some very, very frightening scenes here.
Holy! Holy! What was that? My car looks completely finished.
And I'm not sure if the main monocoque is on the other side of the Armco or not.
At the bottom of the hill is my favourite corner complex on the track. a right-handed kink that only the bravest prototype drivers take flat out, followed immediately by a hard braking into a beautifully open cambered left-hand corner taken in about third gear. This is Indianapolis, named because the bowl-like nature of this left-hander looks like something you'd see on a super speedway. A short chute takes you from Indianapolis into the slowest corner on the track, Arnage. This tight 90 degree left-hander is completely flat and offers no assistance in terms of camber or curbing or anything to get the cars around. You've come from over 300 kilometers per hour, shot the car through two very technical corners, and you've got to bring all of that down to less than 60 kilometers per hour as you desperately try to get the power back on to shoot down what is another journey above 300 kilometers per hour. You're still a long way from home at this point, and any problems here could mean watching the rest of the race from the sidelines.
At this point, the lap is three quarters done, but it's the most technical section that awaits you. The cars are making way down another kilometre of completely flat-out highway, until suddenly they have to make their way back to the permanent circuit, and they do this via the famed Porsche curves. The first part of this is a quick dab on the brakes where you turn to the right, and there's plenty of tarmac and gravel to catch you if you have a problem here. Then the track turns to the left a couple of times. These corners are flat in the prototypes, but not so much in the GT cars. And this speed difference means if you get caught out in traffic here, you're going to drop buckets of time. And as for runoff, well, how close do you want your walls? Yes, there's been runoff added to the second left this year, but there still isn't a lot of room for error. If you're going to hit traffic trouble, it'll be here.
Shoveled out of the way by the LMP2 car. It's Khalid Al-Kubaizi who's gone into the wall. And was that 26 that the shoveling?
Wow.
Big damage on the Porsche, but that, in part, was not his fault. Yeah, look at it again. He just gets muscled into the wall.
You then slow down to 160Ks for a right-hander, which links back to the Bugatti circuit. Then you arrive at Corvette Corner. It looks simple. A left-hander with plenty of runoff and a nice white curb to run over. Simple, right? But we've seen many a race here end through impatience, fatigue, and plain old carelessness.
Look at the Toyota. He's looking. He's probing. Oh, he knocks him.
It's the Delta Wing.
It's the Delta Wing.
Yep.
That was just a mistake by Nakajima right there. He's a rookie here at Le Mans. Was just too aggressive.
Survive the Porsche curves, and a quick chicane brings you back through karting and straight into the built area of the track. Either you peel off into the pits here, or brake hard for the Ford chicanes. Two very tight left-right chicanes. The curves here are high, and will batter the car if you push over them for 24 hours. All it takes is one mistake over this 13.6-kilometre journey for an entire race's effort to end in tears.
And off in the Ford chicane, there's been a big incident for an Aston Martin. It's the 98 car.
It's the arm leader.
Drama in the last hour, and that car is going no further.
The last curb, with Le Mans painted on the inside, brings you back onto the main straight and into the stadium of Le Sarthe in front of 275,000 fans. This 13.6-kilometre journey takes only 200 seconds at the seat of a prototype and only 40 seconds more in a GT car, and takes you from the fastest of the fast to the slowest of the slow. Each lap, a test of the car's design, engineering, and endurance. In the rain, hail, and blistering sun, it takes man and machine to the very limits, and sometimes even beyond them.
Trouble for the number seven there. The race leading Toyota, up to Dunlop, has conked out.
Oh my God! Oh my God! The Mercedes has taken off.
For the Peugeot team,
no.
And the third engine has gone. This is stressful stuff for them.
That's the other Toyota. And another car on its roof. Two cars are there.
Oh, wow.
He knows it's coming by. Is he going to dip out behind him? Oh, no time.
Come to the line. He thinks it's over. It's not. He's ground to a halt.
We have nothing left in the battery, and no engines, so I'm afraid we cannot move more than this. This is the end of the race for us.
Because this is the Grand Prix of Endurance. This is the Circuit de la Sarthe. This is the 24 hours of Le Mans.
The smoke coming off the front left tire. It's wide, and now it's a drag race. And the Aston leads with one more lap to go.
Enjoy it. Well done, crew. Well done. That shows you why you should never, ever give up. You should never give up.
So that was put together by Kiwi Chris 1709. So that was awesome, man. Thank you very much for doing that.
I did a thing that didn't totally suck. Go me.
For the first time in your life. So what is your favorite part of the track, Cookie?
It would probably be the Honduras Strait, Mulsanne Strait, probably before it got neutered. But even now, I still think that much like the end of the, you know, the long straight at Spa, it's in Monza as well, the front straight, that it's one of the last few places where we can absolutely continuously get the cars stressed to their max speed and max capability. And I feel, you know, even after the neutering, it's still, there were so many mistakes made on those two chicanes, and that is by far and away, it's the least intimidating aspect of the track, but it's, I would almost say, some of the most complex, and it absolutely bites you more than it does. So I love that part of it.
That's crazy. I mean, I love it too, but I think busting it in a straight line for for 3 kilometers almost is, I mean, it's not the most exciting thing, but like, as you said, it does stress the equipment a lot and stress the driver as well, because you kind of have to kind of switch off for sitting on that straight for so long, don't you?
220 miles an hour for about a minute and a half. I don't know what it would feel like to go that fast and stay that fast for that long, but to see the things flying by you that fast and to feel the, you know, the bumps and to feel just how on edge the cars may be, and you know, who knows, they feel pretty safe now, but I just the 956 and 962s in the 80s and onboard videos that you can find are just, you just feel like I would keep the pedal down for 10 seconds and then I'd feel like, all right, maybe I can draft somebody. Maybe, you know,
I wouldn't get that far. I'd just take a hard left and go back into the tension of Le Mans.
Well, no, just pull off to the side and hop over the rail and hit that restaurant, have a few beers or shandies while they're driving by.
Just calm down a bit.
it's otherworldly how fast that is, and especially without the chicanes, I just can't imagine that.
Yeah, without the chicanes, it would have been five kilometers, which is about a minute and a half, where your foot is just pinned to the floor. Like, that is just a crazy amount of time.
And of course, this is when the straight had humps and rises, and
the kink was like an actual corner. That would be terrifying. What about you, Kiwi? What's your favorite part of the track?
It kind of depends on the time of day, but overall, I love the Indy Arnage complex.
You and I have the same thought, my friend. So why that complex?
Well, for me, it's just the whole. It's just you got, you know, your bank corners. You got your madness of an even narrower straight than Indy or than the Mulsanne straight. Slowest corners on the track. There's always action. There's always tight racing. In the morning, you got the sunrise, as long as it's not raining. Yeah, and you get some beautiful shots. Get some beautiful shots from that part of the track as well. Absolutely stunning.
Yeah, I just love the way that the track kind of plunges down that hill. Like you're forested on both sides, so you just kind of feel like you're in like a bobsleigh chute or something. You just plunge down the hill, and the track pinches up on around that kink, and you've got to get everything quiet down and braked and all in a straight line again before you get into Indy, which is this beautiful banked corner. And I just, running that section in Sims is just fantastic. And then it just all grinds to a halt at Arnage, where you're back down to like 60 kilometers per hour.
It's probably my favorite piece of track to race on in Forza.
I mean, maybe that and, you know, Road Atlanta.
And maybe, and Bathurst. But anyway.
Now we're getting just a little off topic. What was that, Cookie?
Well, I would say, for pure kind of scenic value, I'd say the run between Mulsanne Corner and Indianapolis is probably my favorite. And that was, I guess even after the fire too, but back before the fire and it was kind of woods on both sides. Oh man, I love watching race cars flying through wooded areas, man. It's just on the ground, not in the air, but that always just kind of gets me in the mood, especially the photography too. There's that shot there, and then the one before Porsche curves, kind of looking down to Arnage. I love those shots. Just looks really, really unique for a racetrack and a really prolific event.
And I think the best thing about, you know, the history of Le Mans is that you can point to any of these corners and rattle off from your head just an important thing that's happened there, or something that's a massive crash or a crazy pass or just something that you would never see anywhere else in the world. Like, as you said, Mercedes CLK flipping into the woods in 1999 in the middle of the race. Like,
three times. That's not Mark Webber.
Mark Webber twice, and then Peter Dumbreck in the race.
Everybody keeps thinking that's Mark Webber, and it's Peter Dumbreck. Peter Dumbreck flew off in the race. Mark Webber flew off in practice and warm-up.
They flew in practice and warm-up. Like, God.
And warm-up.
Yeah.
And the team's aftermath of it. I don't know. That seemed really odd that the car was upside down. Were they not looking at the monitors? Like, did they just think that he just bit it in the wall and it just went whoops and flipped over? Like,
he's Australian. Sure. He's used to being upside down. The team just thought that.
I set that one up.
I smashed it over the rope.
Well done. I've completely lost my train of thought now. What are we talking about?
We're just talking about random accidents that happen. I mean, I could talk about some more if you'd like.
Sure.
Well, we could talk. Well, the Mike Rockefeller that we just heard about too. That was a huge off. Especially in the LMP1 era.
I think a huge off is an understatement. He got tipped into the wall at 300 kilometers per hour in the middle of the night, and it was just literally square on front on impact. Like as we heard in that little piece, they didn't know where the car was afterwards, because this was before the time when they had manned cameras at every single post overnight. They only had static cams down that part of the track, so the car had hit the wall just below the camera shot, and then there was just nothing. You could not see anything. All you could hear was just carnage. It was terrifying. And
pinballing is the word I'd use to describe it.
Yeah, basically.
I only just realized that he actually ended up on the other side of the track where he hit as well.
Yeah, he went from one side back to the inside. So imagine if another car had been coming up behind them and had hit Rocky as well. And I think something that's burned into my memory from watching Truth in 24 and the race that year was hearing Lena Gade call over the radio to, I think it was Lotterer in the car at the time, going, "Rocky is fine, Rocky is fine," and just hearing Lotterer go, "Oh, thank God," because you see that. You see the carnage and the wreckage, and you go, "How has someone survived that?" And that wasn't even the only crash for an Audi R18 that weekend. Like 10 hours earlier, Alan McNish had ended up on his roof at friggin' Forest S's. Just it was a crazy race. And if you want to learn more about 2011 in particular, which I think still holds as one of the best Le Mans races for the overall in history, I just watch Truth in 24 too.
It's on YouTube. It's posted for free. Audi Sport posted. Go watch it.
Yes,
you can find the review for that year too. That really kind of puts just the generic kind of meaning in perspective. But I think it also also shows, just from outside of the human element to it, just how much of an underdog, I guess, sort of, that the Audi team was heading into the daylight, and that they didn't have a commanding lead with their last remaining car. You know, they were trying to chase down Peugeot, who still had a pretty decent lead and a good, I mean, they had insurance with all of their cars still. So I think that was not only, you know, a great human story just for the comeback element from Audi, but just from an entertainment aspect for that race was unbelievable at the top of the order. So
and normally when you get into the last half an hour at Le Mans, it's just kind of, oh, we'll get around to the finish and just enjoy it at this point. But no, that was still racing. The gap at the end was less than 13 seconds, and that was after 24 hours of racing.
Yeah, and that's been the case for the last couple of years, where it's come down to the last couple of laps.
At least in one class.
Yeah, obviously at 2016 with Toyota doing its thing. I think nice. And then last year, the GT Pro battle was bananas.
Absolute hawk. That was one of the best things. So, okay, so I feel like this is a good chance to go a little more in depth into the classes and the cars that'll be racing at Le Mans this weekend. Oh, not this weekend, sorry, in 2 weekends' time, and what'll be at the test day. So let's have a little bit of a look through that. The top class at Le Mans is LMP1, the fastest, most technologically advanced endurance prototypes the world has ever seen. These cars rival F1 cars for their overall speed and lap times, while accelerating faster out of the corners and weighing in over 150 kilograms heavier than their single-seater counterparts. The cars are designed to maximize efficiency using the most current technological developments to achieve this goal. The fuel flow of the cars is limited, as well as the amount of energy available per lap, forcing drivers to lift and coast to extract the maximum amount of pace per lap. This class has 10 cars for Le Mans. The two from Toyota are the only two hybrid cars in the class this year. This means they will have a reduced fuel allowance to counter the intrinsic advantage of the hybrid drive. The remaining eight, three BR1 Dallaras, two Ginettas run by Manna, two Rebellion R13s, and one Bicolor's CLM Nismo, are all combustion engine only, and thus get a bit more fuel to use. To ensure a more level playing field, the class is balanced by a process called Equivalence of Technology, or EOT. This process maintains the advantage of the hybrid drive, but brings the privateer teams closer on overall pace. The LMP1 cars feature all-pro lineups and are designed to last the full 24 hours. At Le Mans, the cars will travel further than in an entire F1 season. They are a living, racing laboratory for new technology.
The second class based on pace is called LMP2, consisting of 20 cars. The class is made up of three chassis, Orica, Dallara and Ligier, with the single Alpine car being a rebadged Orica chassis. These prototypes bear no resemblance to road cars, as they are optimised for low drag and for creating downforce with the use of a front diffuser, rear wing, flat floor and rear diffuser. The cockpit is small to help cut through the air, but must have space for two occupants, hence why the drivers are to one side of the car. Their race numbers are blue to help differentiate from the other prototypes. They are all powered by the same naturally aspirated 4.2-litre Gibson V8 engine providing 600 bhp through the rear wheel. Fuel tanks are sized to last around 10 laps at Le Mans between pit stops. Expect lap times to be around 3 minutes and 30 seconds. If there is a significant performance gap, the ACO reserves the right to add up to 30 kilos, reduce fuel tank capacity up to 10 litres, and make aerodynamic restrictions, usually to the ride height. Another way of balancing the class is through the drivers. As this is not a fully professional class, each car must have at least one silver or bronze rated driver out of the three in the team. This is where the gentleman drivers come in, sharing the driver's seat with gold and platinum rated stars. This provides an intriguing class to follow, where some cars are faster and slower in different phases of the race depending on who's driving. An addition to this year is Michelin coming to the class as a tyre supplier, creating a tyre war with Dunlop. This is the only class with multiple tyre brands, with Michelin used by a quarter of entries in P2. The LMP2 class is designed around the objectives of reliability, safety and low maintenance cost to enable racing near the top level on a consistent budget through the field. It is not a place for large investments over your competitors. It provides a proving ground for young sports cars talent to graduate up to the pro classes and an opportunity for amateurs to race at first class events.
Take six of the most desirable road cars that exist, throw in 50 of the world's best GT drivers, and you end up with a down and dirty French street brawl. GTE Pro sees 17 manufacturers from Porsche, Aston Martin, BMW, Corvette, Ford and Ferrari take to the track in what will likely be the most enthralling class at this year's race. These cars are stripped down, out and out racing machines. The racing is close and hard, and this is helped by the three most controversial words in motorsport: balance of performance. The cars are subject to balancing by the ACO in an attempt to keep the racing close and stop the manufacturer teams from buying their way to success. We've seen the mistakes of GT1 where the class died out due to out-of-control costs, and no one wants to go there again. Teams will be accused of hiding their true pace, they'll moan about how BAP is not fair, but if all the teams moan about it, it probably means the ACO's done it right. Even the tyres are one make this year, although there's a wide variety of choice in the Michelin range. GTE Pro is also home to the best GT drivers going around. While they are technically allowed, there are no bronze or silver drivers to be found here. There's even only six gold-rated drivers amongst the field. They all have to be in the car for a minimum of 6 hours, and there's no weak driver here to instantly push a car out of contention. It's going to come down to which cars and which drivers negotiate traffic and the M class, and are smart about being passed by the prototypes, prove reliable and consistent across the 24 hours. And if it comes down to the last lap, as it did last year, boy, are we in for a treat. So pay attention to the class with the green numbers. It's going to be a good one.
The last class on the grid based on pace is GTE AM, standing for amateur, and is made up of 13 cars. The amateur nature of the class is similar to that of LMP2, but with GT cars. These are based on road cars and are modified into GTE machines with more aero grip over their GT3 cousins. As the cars are fundamentally different from each other, and to keep the variety on the grid, balance of performance, or BOP for short, is required to help level the playing field. Based on previous pace in the season, BOP can adjust the following parameters of the car before the race. The weight of the car with ballast, an air restrictor on the engine, or adjusting boost pressure, the fuel tank capacity, and the height of the rear wing. The cars are similar to the GTE Pro cars, but with a slight downtune of the BOP to give a clearer definition between the GT class lap times. Despite these slower lap times, this is still a very competitive class. The chassis taking part are 6 Porsche 911 RSRs, 2 of the older non-turbocharged Aston Martin V8 Vantages, and 5 of the older Ferrari 488s without the brand new Evo upgrades that are on the Pro car.
So we've got basically 4 different races happening on track at once. There's 60 cars and 30 prototypes, 30 GT cars, and we have 4 different races happening on track at once. So how does that work? For someone who's never seen anything outside of, say, F1 or touring cars, how does having 4 different classes of car on track actually work?
It works because all of them are not the same speed. So all of them basically run the race that they can for the allotted time, and they are racing the fellow competitors in their class, but naturally, as they circulate around the track, they will encounter slower and faster cars, potentially depending on their class, and they'll have to navigate those just as their competitors will. And managing your competition as well as the other traffic that's on the track at the same time is how you end up with the results you earn. So I feel like that is a really technical way to describe it, but it is sort of simplistic.
But it takes a lot of cooperation, a lot of patience from especially the lower class traffic. And if you get amateur drivers who maybe not have raced too much in multi-class racing previously, they can be problematic. And we've seen in the past races like Rockefeller's crash we talked about before was caused by a GT driver who took a bit too much racetrack when he wasn't supposed to.
But, so, it is very difficult, especially I'd say now with the speed differential between the prototypes and the GT cars, to sort of be able to judge how fast a prototype car is going to be approaching you and how much room you'll have to give them. Because, I mean, if you looked in that same year, the 2011 year with Alan McNish, that crash was entirely caused by Alan McNish diving for a hole that wasn't ever going to appear, and it put them out of the race within the first hour. But sometimes you just kind of also end up with crashes that don't really have anyone at fault. And, you know, it's one of those things about in endurance racing and multi-class racing that sometimes you just don't get lucky. I'm trying to think of a particular instance where that sort of happened.
None comes to mind to me, Flood. Well, I'll just have to keep thinking.
Because all the ones in recent years now have been sort of prototype cars doing something stupid, like Roman Rusinov last year, you know, diving on the inside of the Porsche curves to a GT car. It's just like that's only going to end up with both of you in the wall. And what happened? Both of them were in the wall.
Davidson's crash at Mosan Corner, that was caused by Ferrari being stupid, wasn't it?
I'd say it was still just a Ferrari just not having paying attention and just turning in when there was already a car there. Even something like Matteo Vaxivier's incident last year with Pierre Caffer on the Mulsanne straight, it was just inattention, not being sure of where the other car was, and then all of a sudden Pierre Caffer's in the wall at 300 kilometers per hour. And I've got to say, I saw a video of that crash recently, and extremely well done by the marshals at that post where Pierre Caffer went straight in, because the guy who was facing back with the blue flag saw the crash happen and just ran to the side and pulled the yellow flag guy with him just way out of the way. And if that hadn't happened, they would have been like showered with shrapnel. So well done to that guy.
Yes, and good points when you raised. Yes, they have rear view cameras now, so the rear visibility is easier, and the headlights are so bright now they can, like, the slower cars do get a better idea when the prototypes are approaching, but it's still a massive speed difference, and it's not something you can learn until you're out on track.
Yeah, and if you have a lapse of concentration, you have a lapse of concentration. There's not a whole lot you can do, and that's more likely to happen with gentleman drivers who are one. You know, I would say they are some of the most inexperienced rookies and new race car drivers that are racing in such a prolific event. They are very green to even motorsports a lot of times, so that risk is pretty high.
And I think gentleman drivers as a concept is something that a lot of people may not have encountered outside of sports cars. And so why does the WEC and Le Mans in particular have these classes that are just for amateurs, just for business owners or rich people who want to come to these events and race and be 4 or 5 seconds off the pace?
Well, amateur drivers have always been linked with Le Mans and sports car racing. You know, they're the ones that provide the money. They're the ones that are potentially the most passionate about it. And we've had gentleman drivers in the past, like Sir Chris Hoy, Patrick Dempsey, Paul Newman, you know, have had amazing careers. Steve McQueen, amazing careers doing something else, but they love motorsport that they come to Le Mans to just enjoy their racing and succeed while doing it. Patrick Dempsey, obviously, his wife's told him no more racing.
Which is the saddest thing ever.
Yeah, but didn't Steve McQueen win this one year?
I feel like he came second. He either came second here or at Sebring. I don't think he won.
Yeah, Sebring, sorry, yeah. I always get those two mixed up.
There's something that Steve McQueen said. Oh, I think it was Steve McQueen. I have a pretty strong feeling that it was Steve McQueen. He said, life is racing. Anything else in between is just waiting for the next race, or something to that effect.
Yeah.
It's just waiting.
That quote was on our Supercars intro coverage for the last 12 months, so it sticks it in our brains.
Yeah, and it sort of shows how much passion that the amateur drivers bring to the sport. And, you know, a lot of these guys are not full-time drivers. They're fantastic drivers. I mean, Paul Dallalana is one of the most skilled amateur drivers behind the wheel of an Aston Martin, but he's still an amateur. He's still in a car with a former F1 driver who will, outstrip him at every corner. But the fact that he's been around for so long and is so experienced really just elevates him a step above, say, someone, a few of the other amateur drivers. But still, there's whenever an amateur driver puts in a fantastic drive and can battle with the pros, everyone takes notice. And I feel like, I think it was David Hennemeyer Hansen at Nürburgring last year, the drive he put in an LMP2 car was just phenomenal. And everyone was saying that was the drive of the day because he was battling guys like Bruno Senna and Gustavo Menezes and beating them. Mm. And this is the guy that friggin' invented some programming language. Is it Ruby?
I don't know. I'm not a programmist.
Programmist. Yeah, I think it's one of those.
Yeah.
But also, the amateur class is also good for another reason, in that you get your up-and-coming drivers who haven't quite burst onto the scene, but they're about to. People like Matt Campbell, Julian Andauer, you know, just waiting, just Porsche juniors who are in the amateur class, honing their skills to when they make it big.
Yeah, Mattia Cairoli is another one that fits into that archetype. And as you said, it is just a fantastic opportunity for these guys to get factory driver experience without the pressure of a factory team. So, yeah, it's another good thing. But also in that class, you've got guys like, as I said, Pedro Lamy. This year, we've got Giancarlo Fisichella racing in one of those cars. Jörg Bergmeister, for example. You've got a weird mix of super professional drivers, young up-and-coming talent, and then actual amateurs, people who do this on the weekend for fun.
And don't forget, too, with gentlemen drivers and amateurs as well, that they also have the ability to compete for, you know, different wins as well in terms of overall and class wins. Notably, too, we had an amateur driver potentially even winning Le Mans last year had JCDC manage to hold off Porsche, essentially. Almost say essentially, but then obviously in the 90s and 80s, in especially in the 70s as well, that you had amateur racers that would have a pro driver, or they'd have two, and they would basically kind of supply the funds for the team to compete for an overall victory. Obviously, with Don Winnington and the Winnington brothers back in 1980 when they won the overall victory at Le Mans. So I think there's a lot of that amateur drivers and especially gentleman drivers can give. And while we're not potentially seeing them go out and win constantly, or at least be at the front of the field, they're still given opportunities to win. Even in LMP1 class this year.
Yeah, it is. It is a very special thing that we can have quote unquote regular people go to these events and be competitive. And it's I want to do that someday. When this podcast takes off and makes me a lot of money, I'm going to go race on one.
Well, we're talking about, you know, some of the modern day stars, and you're talking about some of the Jelgen Gentleman drivers, but there's been so many fantastic and so many, I guess, legend drivers that have raced here and won here, and cars as well.
Statement, yeah. I think racing here and winning here makes the legend, not the other way around. I mean, there are a few people who have come from F1 and from IndyCar and from other motorsports and come here and won, and everyone's like, oh, that's understandable because they're already a legend, like the Dan Gurney sort of type, or the Carroll Shelby, you know, those sort of people who already had that prestige behind them, or the Mike Hawthorns as well, and Stirling Moss and Juan Manuel Fangio back in the early 50s. But there's also a group of people, more so towards the 70s and 80s, that came here and made Le Mans a castle, basically. And one in particular, two in particular I can think of, is Jackie Ickx and Derek Bell, pairing that between them, just the two of them, let's not forget, won, I think, 4 Le Mans together, and then Ickx won a further 2, and Bell won another 1 later on in his career. So, but the fact that as a pairing, they won, like, 5 out of 4 in a row when Porsche was just winning everything is outstanding. And let's not forget about the brands as well. Like, the brands here, the brands of cars make their name, like, similar to what Ferrari have done in F1. You think sports cars and you think Le Mans, and it's synonymous with Porsche, it's synonymous with Audi, things like Jaguar and Ford as well back in the day. It's really been a place where legends are created.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the one thing that sticks out to my mind is that Ford v Ferrari battle of the late 60s.
Oh, yeah. That has a story behind it in itself, and I think that story is fantastic.
Yeah. Yes. So, basically, you know, Ferrari had won in 65, I think, and at the time, Ferrari were looking to buy out Ford. You can correct me if I'm wrong here.
The other way around.
Other way around. Ford looking to buy Ferrari. The deal fell through because of Ferrari's Italian owners being like, what the hell is this bullcrap?
It was actually Enzo Ferrari himself that had to sign off on the deal at the very last step, and he wouldn't do it.
Yeah. So Ford decided, you know what, stuff it. We're going to beat a car that destroys the Ferrari on the track. And then the GT40 came to be.
Which is a European chassis developed by basically a genius and just with the Ford badging on it, that's all.
Yeah. Still, it was still the brainchild of, yeah, some of the biggest American motorsport designers of the time, and it destroyed the competition. The first race that the first Le Mans they appeared at, they won by 21 laps over the next car. So the top three were 4 GTs. The next car down was 21 laps behind, and none of the Ferraris that competed that race actually finished it. None of the factory Ferraris finished it. And I think you, Kiwi, have a very specific interest in that particular car, don't you? Maybe something to do with the drivers?
What car was that? The
1966 victory.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God, Kiwi, I set you up perfectly.
You got this. Come on, Kiwi.
Kiwi, please.
Oh, that.
Who won in 1966?
Who won in 1966?
Of course we're talking about the Kiwis, Bruce McLaren and Chris Amon. Of course I knew that. What do you think I am? Stupid?
Yes.
No, I absolutely knew that. You know, that, as a proud Kiwi, hey, you got two iconic names in that one car. They were so iconic. Obviously, Bruce McLaren.
The funny thing was, they didn't actually cross the line first in that race. Back then, there was a interesting little caveat in the rules that it was whichever car had covered the most distance after 24 hours, not whoever had crossed the line first after 24 hours. And because the winning car, the number one car, had started on pole, whereas the Amos McLaren car had started from fourth, when Ford decided to stage a dead heat for the finish, they actually handed the victory to the Amos McLaren car.
So what you're saying is they deserved it totally, and there was nothing underhand about it.
Oh, no, right. Not at all.
Right, absolutely. That was a well-earned victory. They lapped the feet. Yeah.
Yeah. Come on, New Zealand drivers don't win too many of these. Give us something.
New Zealand drivers have won two of them won last year.
That's not enough.
I mean, you literally prevented one of the most gorgeous Ferraris sports cars of all time not to win that year, and I don't like you for that. So the 330 should have won Le Mans at some point.
But
save the 312.
It just kept breaking down. But that's one of the best eras of, I think, Le Mans history, just simply for the off-track drama that was happening around it. But I think another era that we can't go without talking is Group C. The best formula of sports car regulations that we've ever seen until maybe the last 4 years. But Group C racing was basically the cars were given a certain amount of fuel, and that was it. They could do basically whatever they wanted with that amount of fuel. And it birthed some of the most iconic cars for the World Endurance Championship at the time, this World Sports Car Championship, some of the most fantastic battles, some of the most iconic teams as well. And it's just, like, you look back at that era and you had, like, five or six factory teams. You had Porsche, you had Sauber, Mercedes, you had Toyota, I think, for a little while. Is that correct, Cookie?
Yes. Yeah. Lancia, Mercedes, I think you said that already. Nissan, dipped their hat in a little bit.
Nissan, and one that we haven't mentioned that we should is Jaguar as well. The battles between the Rothmans Porsche and the Silk Cut Jaguars at the height of Group C's popularity is just one of those things that is legendary and iconic in its own right, let alone in the context of Le Mans.
Preach. One of my favorite, and that's the thing. There are so many good cars that in this era that I don't even know which one to place first. For a while, I think probably my favorite car is the Mercedes C11, which is 1990-91.
Is that the
version?
Is that the one that they built and then didn't race at Le Mans, or is that the one that they?
That's the C291.
Okay,
that one has the weird kind of front wing lip thing to it. The C11 is almost a cross between that and the C9. It's just it almost looks like how the CLK used to look, and then the CLR came out and it was like basically smoothed out. It was a smoothed out version of the CLK. In the GT1 era, it was like that. So, like, nice. The C9 was kind of bulky a little bit. The C11 was just a little bit more, smooth. The crappy – just I hate this because they obviously had problems in 1991, which credited him for winning it. But they should have won in 1990 had they gone. They just decided to appease the FIA and go along with what the FIA was doing, which was skipping Le Mans that year. So Mercedes didn't go to Le Mans, even though they had a perfectly good C11 that was perfectly within the regs back then at the time. And would have won it.
But that 1990 race is important in its own right because it enabled one of the most unique and most iconic cars of Le Mans to go there and win. And of course, we're talking about the Mazda 787B, one of the craziest cars that's ever graced the circuit of Le Mans.
Craziest sounding. I think it screams.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you have a four rotor in the back of it. Instead of a
dispensation, don't forget.
Yeah. It wouldn't be Le Mans without special dispensation.
I'll have some special dispensation.
I was going to say, the cars have undergone so many evolutions as well. Even the GT cars in recent years. You've gone from GT1, which was those absolute manic things like the Maserati MC12 and the Jag and the B12 Aston and Celine and Lambos, the old Ford GT.
And then now you've moved from that to a sort of GT2 kind of thing, which was like the next level down, but that's already at the speed of those cars now anyway. And then
it's
kind of nuts how fast the development of these cars has just increased. But yeah, that's racing at Le Mans. There was something else I wanted to say. And if we look more recently to the more recent years, there's two things that go together like cookies and cream at Le Mans, and that is Audi and taking Le Mans victories.
They were they were completely and utterly dominant. There's no word for it.
There's definitely no other word for it. Their first win as a manufacturer was in the year 2000 at the seat of the R18. For the next... including 2000, out of the 15 years from 2000 to 2014, they won 13 of those, only being beaten in 2003 by a Bentley, which is basically a Audi R8 with a green British racing skin on it. With Audi's drivers, let's not forget. And the one win that Peugeot managed in 2009, I think. So in that 15-year period, they won 13 events. They rocketed from nowhere to being the second most winningest manufacturer in Le Mans history. And then the most winningest manufacturer in Le Mans history came back and showed them how it's done.
Wow, boy, just putting that qualifier on the back there. I will say 2003 with the Bentley, I think even to further solidify your point, that was based on what, the Audi R8C, that was the coupe version of the Audi R8 that beat in, like, I think, 1999. And so they kind of just shelved that, and that was like the British version, because that's how Audi pretty much started. They were like, here, the British team, go make us a coupe. And then I think it was the American side built the open top.
Yeah.
And then they basically decided to go with the open top. But then the coupe pretty much evolved into what the Bentley was, the Bentley Speed 8. So even then, it was still vague, and it was still really Audi that was the driving force behind.
I mean, Christensen was in the car. It was an Audi. It was an Audi with British racing green.
I don't think anybody complained either, though.
I mean, I wouldn't.
Bentley was gorgeous.
Well, we should talk about Christensen to see we're talking about legends.
Yeah.
Mr. Le Mans?
Mr. Le Mans, yeah. Why is he called Mr. Le Mans?
He only won 9 of them, didn't he?
Only.
Only a few. Yeah. He had to have at least three rows for shelving at his house to the hardware, but... I don't know how he manages.
Absurd. That's absolutely absurd. And it just seemed that, like, whatever car he managed to get in, he won. Like, he was in the Yost Racing, the Tom Walkinshaw Yost Porsche that won in 1997, that beat the factory team in the GT1 car. He was in the Audi when it started getting crazy good. He was in the Bentley when it won in 2003. It just seemed that whatever team he ended up in, it was a team that was going on to win. And I mean, his co-drivers in Alan McNish and Dindo Capello as well kind of been elevated to legend status as well. But the fact that Tom Christensen won 9 of them and won something like 5 in a row is astounding.
Right place, right time. But I think with the amount of years he's had, he's been in the right place, right time. I think there's a common denominator there that isn't him being lucky to be in those positions. I think he's earned that right to be where he needed to be to win those, but the talent was there. Absolutely. And I think we don't have a better Mr. Le Mans, I don't think, right now.
Not even close. And you look outside Tom Christensen, you look at that team as well. Even the team directors and the engineers have become celebrities in the Le Mans paddock. I mean, you know, you talk about Howden Haynes and Lena Gade and Dr. Wolfgang Ulrich and Ulrich Boretzky, the engine designer. Like, even people know the engine designer, for God's sake. Like, that was how dominant this team was. Like, people knew the engineers because of just how perfect the cars were and how much they were in the spotlight because of how much they won. It was just, it's a phenomenal program. And when that came to an end 2 years ago, it did leave a kind of a hole at the top of the World Endurance Championship.
They will be back though. And it's good to see another, not necessarily that it's taken this long to solidify, but I mean, I think Porsche and so many other teams like them or manufacturers have found that kind of mysticism almost about Le Mans and keep gravitating towards it. And I've obviously, from Audi's success, they're going to be back. I don't think that's a question. I think Porsche will always come back to Le Mans. I think Audi will too. It's just it'll be a matter of lining everything up, but they've earned the right to be back here whenever they want to fight for overall wins, that's for sure.
So, but there has been one team that's been sticking around for a lot of years now in the LMP1 category that still hasn't managed to take a win. And I feel like we need to make mention of their efforts at the very least, because they are the favorites this year, and that is the Toyota team. So, Cookie, do you want to give us a brief history on that Toyota team?
The current iteration of the Toyota team started in 2012. It's based in Cologne, so it's more or less the Toyota technical development. I mean, it is still Toyota Racing Development. I think, no, that's the U.S. But it's Toyota's engineering and racing kind of wing for them. And a lot of them are from Oreca. There are a lot of, I think there's a few ex-Peugeot team members that are still with the team, but it is a European outfit. And I think people do associate Toyota with just a full Japanese effort. And while a lot of the marketing and a lot of the funding and obviously the team itself, a lot of it does have its roots in Japan, there's a lot of European collaboration. And that's why you see a lot of a lot of the French language coming out of that that garage as well too. So Hugh Dushanak is one of the leaders of that group, and he's I believe the president or CEO of Oreca, so the chassis manufacturer. So they have a ton of experience, even if they were here for only 3 years. But this is nearing close to 30 years being at Le Mans as a factory or manufacturer competing, with their logo. And unfortunately, they don't have the hardware to show for it, but they've had a lot of strife. But they always seem to come back and say, this is our year. So this is our year.
And Hugh Dushanak is one of the really good guys. He was involved with Peugeot, and I still remember his interview after the four Peugeots failed in that one race in 2010. And that was just so emotional. And he is just one of the good guys, one of the most passionate guys around as well. It'd be nice to finally see him win something.
But the thing is, it just goes to show that this race is not just a procession. It is a full-on endurance test. And, I mean, Toyota have been in race-winning positions four or five times in their history here. And every single time, something has happened that has prevented them from winning. I mean, you just look to last year, where they had easily the best car on track for a lot of the entire weekend and the race, and it was going to be a cakewalk for them, but one mechanical error coming out of the pits burnt out the clutch on the leading car, and then a minute and a half later, the second car was with a puncture going through the first part of the lap and wasn't able to get home. And so, you know, within a few minutes, you'd had both of the Toyotas out of the race, and the race was handed to Porsche. You know, even the year before that, they made it to the last lap before the car broke down, and it was a quote-unquote a 5-cent part on a multi-million dollar car that broke that cost them a Le Mans victory. And like, even if you head back to the days of the Toyota GT1, the TSO10, I think it was 1994, I think, is that the right year?
Yeah. Where, gearbox failure in the front straight.
Yeah, and it's just it just seems that for Toyota at least, it just seems that there's always something. But
yeah, 1999 too was the GT1 that was chasing down the BMW VR or V12.
Yeah, that LM. Was what I was thinking. Yeah,
yeah, and blew a tire there. They had the deltas to win. I think that was with 50 minutes to go too. So they ended up blowing a tire before Indianapolis, and they pretty much were out of it after that. So limping back to the pits, lost too much time and lost it that way. So yeah, but beyond that, even earlier in that race too, Martin Brundle having a brake or tire failure at the wrong time on in one of the chicanes down Mulsanne, absolutely just destroys the front end of the car, and that's basically out of contention for the win. And that was the favorite, and it would had a, just a commanding lead over the entire field. So just, I mean, so much of it is just little things here and there. But again, it just comes down to just not getting enough effort out on track. And at the end of the day, it's just not, finishing the deal. So
I think
one final thing for me, when you guys go, so like this is Le Mans, everything comes back to Le Mans. For me, especially being a Toyota fan, it's been pretty evident that Le Mans just picks its winner, and that there is not a whole lot of, there is a lot of, preparation and practice, but at the end of the day, track ultimately chooses who's going to win. And it's Toyota has just never offered enough.
I would counter with something that Alan McNish always says, and that is you don't believe in luck. Luck is just an excuse for poor preparation. And if you look at the Audi, teams of the 2000s, you can see exactly what he's talking about. I mean, the Audi team replaced the entire rear end of an R8 in 5 minutes. They lost one lap replacing the entire rear end and gearbox of an R8.
That's thinking outside the box. That's engineering a problem to a fix for a problem.
And I'll always remember the 2014 race where Audi changed two turbos on two cars within 20 minutes and came back to win that race as well.
And last year, the overall winners had a massive problem early on in the race and had to fight back from many laps down on the P2.
It was, yeah, they went literally from last to first. And it just goes to show that in especially in endurance racing, you can repair these problems and get back into a competitive position. So yeah, things like gearboxes, things like tires, things like wheels coming off and, you know, broken turbos and that sort of stuff. And the cars are designed with this sort of thing in mind as well. And like the 5 minute gearbox change for that Audi wouldn't have happened if they hadn't had the entire back end modularized to be able to do that. And that's the sort of things that you have to think about in order to win this event.
At the same time, the where they had the issue makes a difference as well, and whether or not that they can make it back, and whether or not they foresaw the opportunity to get to the end or get to the pits because they can make that repair. There's a lot of things too that I feel, if you had a problem, it's really not good to have it on the front stretch as you pass the pits because you have another 7 miles to go to get to the end. So as much as I want to say that there is preparation to it, there is absolutely luck that is involved with this race. And as much as Alan McNish has won this thing and says the preparation does matter, there is absolutely an element of the cards do not fall in your favor, regardless of how much preparation you make. That's just my opinion.
That sounds like something a Toyota fan would say.
And that sounds like something a Porsche fan would say.
Yeah. So I feel like that's a pretty general overview of what the event sort of is and what the event sort of encompasses. But okay, so how do we actually follow this event? How is it structured? So we have, what, the test day coming up soon, tomorrow, in fact, at the time of recording. So the test day is 2 weeks before the main event. All the teams have already been set up in their garages for the week. And it's, I think, what, 2 4-hour sessions?
Sounds right.
And that's really an opportunity for all of the drivers to do their compulsory Le Mans laps if they've never done them before. For the teams to sort of bump into the event and bump into the weekend and make sure that any teething issues have worked out in the cars. Gives us the first opportunity to see the on-track action, sort of try and analyze the testing times to see if we can garner any information from any of them. And let's be real here, we probably won't because it's testing.
And because we've only had the one event at Spa with these cars this year, we're coming into so many unanswered questions that we may not find out until actual race weekend.
We might not even find them out until the last hour of the race, to be honest. And yeah, it really kicks off the festival of endurance that is Le Mans, because not only do you have the test day, you have basically a break week in the middle, and then over the beginning of next week, we'll have scrutineering in the town center. They'll have this big festival where every car will get brought in onto the podium in front of all of the fans that are there, and they'll scrutineer the car to make sure it complies with the technical regulations. They'll do the promo photos and all that sort of stuff, and they do that over 2 days, and it's a massive event in the middle of the town. The entire town gets wrapped into the scrutineering, and this is before there's even any proper actual track action. And I think it's on my bucket list to be able to go to Le Mans for a full 2 weeks and to be a part of that scrutineering event and to be able to pick it apart and watch from the sidelines.
Imagine the amount of free stuff you get.
Oh, I'm all about that free stuff.
Can I have a free car?
It's for me, man.
Can I have a free Porsche jacket?
I don't know, man. You are a huge fanboy, so I don't really... I'm not too worried that you could probably castrate yourself in front of a Porsche driver for a jacket.
Moving on.
What? So how is the actual on-track event action for the 24 Hours of Le Mans event structured?
So the actual event itself starts on a Wednesday with practice. First practice session of 3 hours in the day. Then there's a night qualifying session. And those night qualifying sessions are actually important because each driver's got to do 5 time laps during them. Otherwise, they may not get to start the race. And we've seen that happen quite a bit over the last few years. Thursday as well, you get 2 more sessions, 1 during the day, 1 during the night, for 3 hours each. No action at all on Friday. Friday is the Le Mans parade through the town, and the streets are absolutely packed.
I mean, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you pack the streets to watch that?
Oh, God, yeah. And then, of course, the race starts Saturday, 3 p.m.,
in French time, and 24 hours means it goes around the clock once, twice.
Twice. Oh, Kiwi, you almost had it. but for those who might have seen Spa-Francorchamps, might have a question of why is there three qualifying sessions that go for 2 hours each? And it's still something unique about the Le Mans event in terms of qualifying for the World Endurance Championship, and is that it doesn't matter which session you put a lap in, it's only the best lap time that counts. And it means that these qualifying sessions are, as Kiwi said, part of ensuring that all the drivers do their compulsory timed laps, but also making sure that you dedicate enough time to testing the cars in the night, as well as just setting these quali laps. But still,
you're not going to do 6 hours of going fast. You're going to have race sims. You're going to have practicing your pit stops. Oh crap, this has failed. What do we do? Sort of thing.
Yeah,
simulated failures.
Yeah, but it does. We still do see those crazy lap times, and I don't think any lap time has been any crazier than what we saw last year with Kamui Kobayashi. Ain't that right, Cookie?
Yes, we do have to talk about last year, don't we? Yeah.
Why wouldn't you want to talk about last year though? The fastest ever lap of Le Mans in both time and average speed, and this is including all of the years where we had no chicanes in the Mulsanne straight, where we had 12 corners, where we didn't have the Porsche curves, where we didn't have the Forest S's. This is faster than anyone has ever gone around the Circuit de la Sarthe ever. Ever.
I mean, it looked fast.
It looked terrifying.
It was fast. I was really happy at that point of the weekend. That was by far and away one of the fastest lap that's ever been around the track. But I mean, that's right up there with some of the other legendary pole lap performances that we've seen on boards for. So,
like Mark Blundell in the Nissan, was it R3? No, not the R390.
Turn down the boost, Mark. No, I don't want to. I'm just going to finish the lap. Yeah. Yeah. I think that was 1990, I think. 1990. Yep. Yeah. Yep. So, it's on that caliber for lap. I mean, it's just I my brain can barely keep up watching that thing. So, what a legendary lap! And it really kind of kickstarted the weekend in the high gear in terms for me at least, especially going into that weekend, just to lay down that kind of lap. I think we were thinking like the high 14s, and just to go into the low 14s like that was unbelievable.
Yeah, it was I think it was a 3:14. So we're talking about 3 minutes here. So 3:14.79. So we were looking more towards the 15s, Cookie. But to see a 14 appear was just ridiculous. And the fact that it has a faster average speed than even the Porsche 962 with the full Mulsanne straight hitting like 390 kilometers down it. That is absurd, and it just shows the power of the hybrid technology and the downforce that we had in those cars over that course. Because the top speed of the Toyota TSO 50 is like 330 kilometers per hour. It's nowhere near as fast as absolutely fast as the old Group C cars, but still, it's. An average speed over 13.6 kilometers of 251 kilometers per hour.
Okay.
What?
The thing too with this year is see how the privateers are going to fare and how fast those guys can go. Just because their speed doesn't really taper off due to the lack of hybrid energy, they're going to keep going. So I wouldn't be surprised to see those SMPs kill the speed chart.
That would be very interesting, and I feel like the battles down the Mulsanne is going to be one of the best parts of the race. Speaking of, the race you can kind of split into four different parts. You've got, of course, the start, and the fanfare of the start is fantastic, and to see all 60 cars peel off out of the Ford chicane to start the race is going to be one of the most amazing sights of every year. But it kind of... there's kind of a few discrete kind of landmarks you want to get to throughout the race, isn't there? And the first one is being getting into the darkness.
Yeah, just getting through that first few hours. That's where the traffic can be the worst because obviously start of the race, your GT cars, you're going to have like passing 12 of them in a bunch at once. You're going to be... It's potentially the most where everyone's on edge the most. Yeah, pit crew's on edge the most.
And the track is not lit. I mean, there are parts of the track, especially the purpose-built parts, that have some, you know, ambient lighting, more or less for spectators and crews, that kind of stuff, officials. But there are parts of the track that are just in complete darkness. And so you are having to add the element of basically bobbing and weaving through traffic. A lot of times the huge speed differential traffic from LMP1s to GT traffic during the day, but then amplify that at night while you are basically driving along, looking at reflectors and little other lights here or there, but you're basically on your own. So that is a extremely alienating experience for anybody that's ever even driven a car and never driven at night in that kind of condition before. So I think as much practice as you can afford, you need to get your night practice in. You need to get your experience in at night.
But if you get through the night, you get to something that's called happy hour. And, oh boy, we love it in happy hour.
This is where the fun happens.
So why is it called happy hour? What happens?
Track temps are cool. Ambient temps are cool. You're starting to get the daylight. There's a little bit of energy, too, that kind of comes from, you know, making it through the night. And just seeing that little bit of that hint of sliver of daylight and that hint of the races, you know, on the other side. So... you're going to see some of the best lap times you're going to see all race are going to be then. You're going to see kind of just that a second wind almost from the entire field. So usually that's when a lot of great passing happens, a lot of great racing happens. So.
And then from there, you still have about 8 or 9 hours to get to the flag at that point. Because remember, we're racing in the middle of the summer, so the night only lasts from like 10 p.m. through to 5 in the morning. So you've still got to get to 3 p.m. in the afternoon to get to the flag. So that last stretch is going to be where you buy your ticket to that last hour and make it so that way you can be in the right position to win that race.
Yeah. And you're dealing with, you're dealing with pit crews that have slept for maybe 1 hour or 2 hours. Drivers have slept for 2 hours at most. Engineers who probably haven't slept at all.
And this is not just for the top class cars. This is for everyone down the field. And fatigue is something that will play a part towards the end of the race. And I mean, you only have to look back a few years to say 2015, where the race leading GTE AM car of Paul Dallolana was leading by laps and laps at this point, and had a moment where the driver made a small mistake and was in the wall and was out, and that was it. 45 minutes left to go, and you've just thrown away Le Mans victory.
It absolutely requires a full 24 hours worth of concentration. And I mean, we've seen
even longer.
We've even seen single driver stints in which they've, way early on and whatnot, where we had drivers that should have won it, that just from the exhaustion and the fatigue of having to be the only driver, ended up, you know, missing a shift and wrecking the gearbox and going out. So that's the thing too, is that sure you have three to sometimes four, but now it's three co-drivers that usually are splitting the time between the car. But I don't think you're ever really into a point where you feel 100% in the car after, you know, even to start the 24 hours, because it's still an entire weekend's worth of just constant work and constant testing and all this stuff.
And a constant nervousness and apprehension. Absolutely. And excitement. And that takes a lot out of you as well. But when you get to that checkered flag at 3 p.m. and you hear, you know, whoever's won the Le Mans 24 hours or you finish the Le Mans 24 hours, I'm sure for us at least, it's fantastic to be able to get through, because you know, the way that we do it here on r/WEC is awesome fun. And yeah, it's always great to get through. But yeah, then you have to deal with the post-Le Mans depression. And it's just like, my life is empty now.
Especially harder for some of us who are Toyota fanboys.
Ouch. Ouch. Ripping some of cookie.
Some of us. Well, you know, there's brighter days ahead, I'm sure. And, you know, eventually things will happen. You know, the heat death of the universe, like you always say, will come. So I'm sure Toyota will win before that.
Good fun. So how do we watch this then? How do we watch this event for the 24 hours?
Streaming sources, places to stream. TV is really not really too much of an option unless you're spending a decent amount of money for a nice package wherever you are internationally, or wherever, but streaming is probably your best option now.
Yeah, and the official stream you can buy for the event is quite good. It's get access to all the sessions of Le Mans, maybe not practice. They're still a bit weird about that now. But you get access to all the qualifying sessions and the race, which is the important parts, and all the podium celebrations and all that sort of jazz. And I still feel like it's the best way to watch the race as well.
If you're not in North America.
Yeah.
And of course the test sessions will be available ready at Le Mans. There's no video of that, but if you want to listen to that, you certainly can.
Yep. And I would suggest that everyone tune into Radio Le Mans over the race itself, because they do endurance racing broadcasts better than anyone else. So check them out.
And that's on YouTube, and that'll be on YouTube for Le Mans.
Yep.
Are they going to be at Le Mans this year?
Yep, definitely.
So they can do that.
They've still got the booth there just over the start finish line. One of the best ways to actually follow an endurance event, and I implore everyone who's new to it to try and get a hold of live timing. There'll be live timing links up in the race threads, and what that'll show you is that'll show you a data readout of lap times and positions on track and gaps to certain cars, and that definitely augments the experience of just trying to follow it from what you see on screen, because there's a lot happening in four different races basically at the same time. So to have that extra layer of data gives you that extra level of understanding.
And we have users on our sub that will keep lap charts and be strategy geniuses as well. And
make their own live timing sheets. My God.
Yeah. That one is the best one that I've ever seen. So we'll share that one. So there's a server that was made by a fan that is the best live timing server I've ever used. So we'll get everyone onto that. But finally, we should talk about the community here and how we do the races. So of course we'll have, the race threads, up for the race, as well as all the practice and qualifying sessions. There'll also be the Discord, which everyone should jump in on, because trying to get through a 24-hour race on your own is a bit crap, but doing it in a group with a bunch of other people all supporting, like trying to get through the night together and getting through to the end of the race, I joined the IRC for the first time in 2014, and I've been hooked ever since. It's one of the best parts of being in this community.
And it's just equally past irreverent and sensible. I love about it most.
That's an apt description.
I mean, it gets less sensible when I join, but you know.
Well, yeah, that's a given. But it is a lot of fun, and some of the best moments of Le Mans I have in my memory are just of what's been happening in the Discord channel or in the IRC, and just how we go about the event. And if you have any questions, of course, just comment in the Plenty of Question thread that we have. We've got the Le Mans Primer thread, the Everything You Need to Know thread, or in the Discord channel as well through the race. If you want something explained to you, everyone's going to be super willing and super happy to be able to share that with you guys. So yeah.
We'll be doing that shared scratch pad thing as well, I presume, this year.
Definitely. That was a really fun thing from last year, so I can't wait to be able to do that again. And yeah, it's the biggest race of the year, the biggest weekend of the year, and I'm so excited for it.
Oh yeah. I'm excited to see what you're going to do now that Porsche's not in it.
Well, I am prototype. I don't know. I really don't know. I guess I'm supporting Dallara BR1 because I believe in the program. But all the Porsche drivers have kind of been spread through the field. I guess my focus is going to be now on the GT cars, because Porsche are bringing four of them and they all look fantastic and they've all got crazy driver lineups. And even in the GTM cars, like, I have a patriotic connection to the Proton car with Matt Campbell in it. He's
also the Golf car.
The Golf car with Alex Davison, of course. And, you know, Campbell's co-driver, Julian Adenauer, really impressed me. So I'm really pulling for that car. But, like, it's going to be really interesting for me kind of sitting back and watching it without any ties to a specific team anymore. So, yeah. It's
kind of bike hollers. Bike hollers for the win?
Yes.
We'll see.
Yes. Bike hollers win it. I just want it. Chaos. I just want complete chaos. If Toyota doesn't win it, I want chaos.
For GT to win.
No, oh, yes. No. Yeah, I was going to say, if that's where we're going, one of the GTs got to win it, and it's got to be a 4GT. That would be the best. Somehow all the LMP2s wipe themselves out in a freak rain shower accident in hour 18.
Do not want.
Prediction. First prediction for Le Mans this year.
Also, make sure you pick up the Andy Blackmore Spotter's Guide as well, so that way you can keep track of all the cars and what they look like and how to differentiate between them, of course.
The Andy Blackmore Spotter's Guide is proudly supported by r/WEC.
Yes, we'll be on it again. And I feel like that's everything. Does anyone have anything else that they wanted to add?
Oh, man. Watch out for the tire war. That'll be fun. Dunlop versus Michelin.
There's plenty of F1 drivers as well, not just Alonso and former F1 drivers like Buemi and etc. in LMP1.
Jensen
also
Button.
Jensen
Button.
Yeah.
And I presume we'll be getting more in depth into that as we get closer to the race.
Definitely. We'll have another podcast coming out after the test day talking about each of the teams and drivers and sort of going an in-depth look into where these teams come from and what do we expect from them. So keep an eye out for that as well.
No Garage 56 this year, and this is the second year for 60 entries, correct? Or is this the first
year?
Yes,
second year for 60 entries.
There you go.
And evenly split between prototypes and GTs, which is a little surprising, but hey.
That's what's going to happen. I'm fine with that. See, like, people were freaking out about P2s going away. And it's like, I mean, P1s are going to take precedent, but P2s are always going to be there to fill however much needed. And Jesus Christ, GT Pro.
That's what you need to say.
And I feel like that's everything. Thank you very much, Cookie and Kiwi.
Thank you, Mr. Hostman.
Yeah, you are hosting well.
Thank you very much. And thank you all for listening. I hope this has been informative and it's answered a few questions that you have. If you've still got questions, as I said, either comment them below or jump into one of our comment threads and see if you can find the answers there. But yeah, otherwise, we'll hope to see you for our next episode and for the race itself. Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next time. Peace out.
Gazoo!
Thank you all for listening. I hope this has been informative and it's answered a few questions that you have.
Gazoo! Wait, no, that wasn't the right cue.
I'll fix it up in post.
Oh, good.
I'll fix you up in post.
I bet you'd love to, baby.
Giggity.